So Big Bird offered me a Rice Crisp. I ate the Rice Crisp, and it was a magical experience.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton. Today we're talking about unknown pleasures.
I've never really had something so enlightening, the most glorious taste bonanza.
Little things we think we won't like at all but end up loving. And the all too familiar stuff that catches us completely off guard when all of a sudden it's not quite what we're used to.
It was just like Rice Crisp Super Deluxe. I'm Nick Jordan. I'm a food writer, and I just like eating and chatting. And so I've kind of built my life around those two things. And that's probably a good little summary of who I am.
As a food writer for a pretty influential publication, Nick's used to getting special treatment when he goes out to eat, and usually ends up with a feast of just about every item on the menu. He's become accustomed to eating the finest food at some of the best places around town. So to go above and beyond on his birthday one year, he decided he'd fly to Italy and try what had been dubbed the number one restaurant in the whole world. To say that Nick was excited about the food in Italy is a total understatement. This is his reaction to the first gelato he tried when he was over there.
I really freaked out about it. Like, I think I almost cried just because I thought it was so beautiful.
So naturally, he set his expectations pretty high for this restaurant.
Woke up in the morning, we went for a run because we thought, you know, got to go there like super hungry. We only had a Granny Smith apple for breakfast and we were super fired up. This is going to be the most delicious thing I've ever had. And we got there and it was like extremely intimidating because the facade of this restaurant is just this big like flat wall with no, like, very little signage, no ornamentation. And then there's this huge metal door. I think it was maybe even gold colored, but it's closed. And so you just kind of like, you know, it's got such a big reputation, this place. And so you feel like you don't really know how to interact with it.
Nick describes walking into the restaurant like walking into a boardroom full of CEOs. There are men in suits with excellent posture who call you sir, speak really softly and have extremely good eye contact. And basically everyone is treated like royalty. And to Nick, well, it all started to feel just a little claustrophobic.
I mean, everything is packaged with so many ideas and some of them are really fun. Like their most famous one is, oops, I smashed the lemon tart, where it's like a deconstructed lemon tart and a plate with all these fiddly little elements. And it's really delicious. But all of these things are served in such a way to make it really just way too serious and really uncomfortable. And maybe some people like that because they feel like they're being treated like royalty or something. But it wasn't my jam.
So for Nick, obsessed with food in the best restaurant in the world, the whole experience is totally underwhelming. And he can't help but compare it to a moment back in time when he was traveling in his own backyard on a bicycle tour of Tasmania.
So we had a rendezvous point, which was like outside this national park campsite that we'd been staying in. So in that morning, five of us who'd stayed there, we had to really pump it to get out in time. And it just so happened in that morning, there was a really strong wind pushing against us. And then so no one ate breakfast. Well, I don't know, maybe someone else had a little snacko or something, but I had nothing. And we got out and we just started pumping it. And there was a really strong headwind and it was a really, really difficult, arduous journey. When we did get to this particular moment where we had 5 or 10 minutes, I was like totally starving. It was ridiculous. Like, you know, the thing where it feels like your intestines are kind of like moving on top of each other like a snake orgy.
But they're in a national park. So he turns to his friend and he asks desperately if he has any food at all that he can share.
I had nothing. And I remember saying to one of my friends, I think it was Big Bird. I said, hey, you know, Big Bird, do you have any snacks? He's like, oh, I got a Rice Crisp. You want a Rice Crisp?
Now, for a food critic, a Rice Crisp might just be the most boring thing you can eat.
I just associate them with, you know, those things, bad packaging material, maybe like the kind of styrofoam which has lots of different colours in it.
But he had no other option.
And I ate the Rice Crisp and it was a magical experience. I've never really had something so enlightening. Even though it's still, you know, it like didn't taste different to a Rice Krisp. This is the thing I always have trouble explaining. It was just like Rice Krisp Super Deluxe. The most glorious taste bonanza.
So how would Nick rate the best restaurant in the world?
Osteria Francescana would be way, 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 way down the list. Nothing has been as mind-blowing as the Rice Krisp experience. That's for sure.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and we're talking about unknown pleasures. By this stage of our lives, we've started to form pretty solid ideas of how the world should be. We think we know what we like and what we don't. We've come to expect certain things based on our experience, like Nick and the food that he served at restaurants. We're familiar with the streets of our towns, we know the kind of films we like, and when that certain classic song comes on at a party, we've got a pretty good idea of how the room will react. But for some of the people in our next story, when they came to Australia and heard familiar music from their hometowns, they got quite a surprise.
I was working at a place in Memphis called Sun Studio. It's like where Elvis and Johnny Cash and all those guys recorded.
That's Jake. He grew up in Memphis, Tennessee and worked as a tour guide at Sun Studio. Travelers come from everywhere to see what many refer to as the birthplace of rock and roll. And about 4 years ago, an Australian woman called Victoria popped by.
She came into Sun to take the tour, and it just, I don't know, one thing led to another, and I wasn't even her tour guide. I was just at the front counter. I wanted her to come to like some bluegrass show that night. Next thing you know, I'm moving down to Australia to be with her, yeah.
Jake's in Memphis right now, waiting on a permanent residency visa for Australia. But him and Victoria have been living in Canberra.
Yeah, so we were on these on a road trip somewhere. I can't even remember, maybe the South Coast or something like that. And we always listen to this podcast, The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn.
Broadcasting from parts unknown, USA. It's The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn.
He just plays all sorts of different, you know, music, mostly rock and, well, anything he wants, really. And the song came on, the Nutbush came on.
We're going to start off this episode with this. Ike and Tina Turner from 1973 with Nutbush City Limits.
And my partner, Victoria, she said, it's a good song. It's a shame the dance ruined it for me. And I said, well, what dance? What are you talking about? And so she told me, and then once we got out of the car, she showed me.
If you grew up in Australia, chances are you've probably seen or danced along to the Nutbush that Jake's talking about at weddings, school dances, festivals. If you haven't seen it, it's like a repetitive sort of line dance, and it involves tapping your feet around to the right, to the left, to the back, and then these little high kicks. And then you jump around and do it all again.
And then I was really curious about it because Nutbush, Tennessee is really close to where I grew up. So I just started asking people, and I realized as I would ask people, generally they wouldn't tell me about it. They would just like, almost like a reflex, just start doing it. Like wherever I was, like I would ask people I worked with or just anywhere. I'd be like, what is this deal? What is this Nutbush dance? Do you know anything about it? And people would just start busting it out.
It just didn't make any sense to Jake at all.
It's like I didn't understand the pairing of this particular dance with this particular song and why like so many people seem to know it. And it only seems to exist like in Australia.
Not only was Jake unfamiliar with the dance, it was also the first time he'd ever heard the song.
I mean, I knew a lot about, you know, Ike Turner and like Rocket 88, because he cut that at Sun.
The studio where Jake worked.
And so I knew about that because that's, you know, generally considered to be like the first ever rock and roll song. So I knew Ike, of course. But yeah, I never really thought about that song, the Nutbush. Tina Turner, I always think of like, what's love got to do with it, you know, would be probably what would come to mind.
It turns out Jake wasn't the only one totally confused about the Nutbush. Even among people who know all of Tina Turner's catalogue by heart.
So my name is Rebecca O'Connor and I'm from Ireland in a small town called Cove.
Rebecca O'Connor is a Tina Turner tribute artist. She's been familiar with Tina's work since she was a little girl in Ireland.
So both my parents are white, Michael and Anne O'Connor. So they adopted me in Cork and I was the only black girl in the village growing up. And there was one day, I remember my dad said, he calls me Becky. He said, Becky, come downstairs. There's a woman I want you to see. She's on the television. And it was Tina Turner. And I just couldn't get over that there was somebody else the same color as me, first of all. Out there, I thought I was the only black girl. I thought I was the only different one. And it was just, I just found her amazing. The big hair, the big powerful energy that she had. And there was just something about her that I loved. And I always said I wanted to do that and go on the stage. And I wanted to be on a stage and performing and stuff.
Rebecca's been performing shows as Tina Turner in cities all over the world. But she still remembers the first time she did a show in Australia.
I remember it was Dennis actually rang me, Dennis Dunstan.
That's her manager.
He rang me to come over in 2010 to do the Audi Food and Wine Festival. And I've been singing all for most of my life and performing the Nutbush all over Britain, Ireland, for years.
So she's at this food festival show in Noosa in Queensland.
I decided to sing the Nutbush. And everybody was just up doing like an Irish dance, is what I call it, would be an Irish country dance. I could not get over it. I was like, what are these people doing? I was like, what the hell is going on here?
But after that, she pretty quickly got used to what would happen when she'd sing Nutbush City Limits.
I experience it at every single event I play at in Australia. I just did the Gympie Muster like to about 5,000 people, and they were just all going off for the Nutbush. It just went off.
And it doesn't even have to be the actual Nutbush song to get people up and Nutbushing. Sometimes all it takes is any song in 4/4 time. There's a family video of my sister's 13th birthday in 1989. So there's a bunch of teenage girls in our old backyard wearing denim shorts over stockings and big scrunchies in their hair. And this song comes on. La Bamba, the Los Lobos version. I think it was big around the time because of the Ritchie Valens movie. Anyway, I'm just a chubby toddler eating cake in the video, but my sister and her friends all jump up into line and start doing the Nutbush, which works out perfectly to the beat of La Bamba. People in Australia get excited enough when the actual Tina Turner Nutbush song comes on, but sometimes they just can't wait. Ash is a friend of mine who used to dance the Nutbush in a different way, to a different band. And like a lot of kids in New South Wales, Ash learned the dance at school.
We all had to learn bush dances, and Nutbush was one of them. Like, and also we just kind of did like these bush, like these kind of like almost American do-si-do style bush dances to things like You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC and stuff like that. So it was pretty rad. I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
She worked out doing the Nutbush was a really good way to keep fit, but...
I don't know. Being a quite awkward preteen and teen, and then turning into a totally awkward human, I decided that I didn't like exercising in public. Like, the idea of actually physically going out and running around in front of people, just bleh.
So the only place she felt comfortable exercising was in her bedroom. And she was also a pretty big Green Day fan at the time.
And because I found 103.9 Smoothed Out Slappy Hours, which is their first album, and I bought it and I thought, oh, this is the coolest thing ever. And when I was listening to it, I realised that pretty much the entire album is in 4/4, which is great for the Nutbush. So, there's like every single song on this is for my workouts.
Can I play a little bit?
Okay. You have to get up and do the Nutbush. Here we go.
Right now, Ash is doing the most amazing version of the Nutbush in double time to a Green Day song. The Nutbush song and dance just hold a really weird, special place in people's memories for strange and different reasons. But how did the dance even begin? From a Tina Turner song about an American town, danced only in Australian cities and towns, and sometimes to Green Day songs. When When Jake was trying to trace the Nutbush dance to its origin, the best answer he got was from someone on Reddit who said that when Neville Wran was Premier of New South Wales and Eric Bedford was Education Minister, the Department of Education offered incentives and retraining initiatives to teachers in 1978. The theory goes that this retraining was outsourced to a company of consultants who thought that line dancing was a good way to fill the requirements of physical education and creative arts as well. And they were particularly enthusiastic about a popular dance called the Madison, which works well to the 4-4 time signature and tempo of Nutbush City Limits. But no one can say for sure how the Madison morphed into the Nutbush dance we know today. All we can say is that no one in America is doing the Nutbush. Jake drove to Nutbush, Tennessee recently, the town that song's actually about.
And there was this just this abandoned building with a big sign on it that said, "Welcome to Nutbush, Tennessee, home of birthplace of Tina Turner."
But the town's unincorporated, there's nothing there. The visitor center and museum's down the highway in a town called Brownsville.
And, you know, they have a big map and people have visited from all over the world. And I noticed there was a lot of pins down in New South Wales and in Australia. And so I asked, you know, "Have you ever heard of this dance?" And they hadn't heard of it, but she wanted to see it. So I had to do my best. I think I got it. I think I did okay.
So Jake, in the middle of the visitor center in Brownsville, Tennessee, starts doing the Nutbush.
But to just bust it out right there, that's the first time she had heard of it as well.
So who knows? Maybe the Nutbush dance will slowly take hold in the United States, the way it has in Australia for the last 30-odd years. For Jake, who's about to be a permanent resident of Australia, it's like this nice comforting combination of his old country and his new one.
It sort of like pulls from two different places that I feel really close to. You know, I think that's part of it as well. And being so far away from home, any sort of thing that makes me like think of that, I'm kind of like drawn to or attracted to, things that make me think of being back home. And so that song in particular, you know, she's naming stuff in Nutbush, but it's really just any little southern town. So it kind of makes you think about like anywhere back home in the South. I think that's part of what it is.
That story was by Michaela Morgan. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton. Growing up, Chloe would spend her school holidays and sick days with her grandparents, which she loved. Enjoying all this time together made her think she knew them inside and out. For example, she knew that at 4:30 every afternoon, her nan would be watching The Bold and the Beautiful. And every morning, her pa would be doing the crossword in the Herald. But recently, something happened to remind her that they're still capable of surprises. Maybe she didn't know them as well as she thought, and while this is beginning to sound like a dramatic tale of family secrets that could well be found in an episode of Bold and the Beautiful itself, it's not. It's simply a story about a surprise relationship with a book.
I'm part of a very small family. My mum's side peaks at only 11 members, and I have no siblings. As a result, I forged very strong relationships with my parents and my grandparents. When I was growing up, the school holidays would roll around and my mom would drive me up to the Central Coast to spend some time with my grandparents, or Nan and Pa, as I call them. I loved those trips. Nan would take me on big outings. She'd buy me those giant chocolate hard ice creams that mum would never buy, and then take me to see movies like The Incredibles or an Ashton Kutcher film. My memories of Pa are a bit different. More solitary and more grounded in nature. We went on lots of bushwalks together, and whenever I was scared of snakes or spiders hiding in the bushes, he would show me how to stomp loudly as you walk to alert nearby animals. Back at home, Pa was always reading, every time with a different book with a different cover that I didn't recognise. Unlike Nan and me, I don't think I've ever seen him watch a Hollywood movie, let alone a soap opera. Honestly, the only film I think I've caught him watching is The Castle. No, books have always been his thing. I can remember him reading books on Australian history, devouring Tim Winton, and of course, Miles Franklin, his favourite author. But recently he started reading a different kind of book, a book that I had no problem recognising. You might have heard of it. It's called The Cuckoo's Calling. It's a detective novel by an author named Robert Galbraith. He was obsessed with it. At every family event, Pa would bring up The Cuckoo's Calling. At Easter, he mentioned how great the writing was. By Mother's Day, he wouldn't stop talking about the captivating mystery. By my birthday, he had gotten his hands on the next part in the series, and by Christmas he was counting down to the final book. If you haven't heard of it, The Cuckoo's Calling was first released in April 2013, and at the time it made almost no mark in the literary world. It sold a few hundred copies in the first 3 months and was sitting at number 4,709th on the Amazon bestsellers list. But in July that same year, it skyrocketed to number one, nearly overnight. Why? It was revealed that Robert Galbraith was actually a pseudonym. The real author was J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame. Now, I grew up obsessed with J.K. Rowling and all things Harry Potter, but I really didn't understand why my grandpa, with his strong country roots and an aversion to anything in mainstream pop culture, he'd never even considered reading Harry Potter, was now calling J.K. Rowling his second favourite author. I didn't get it. Other family members had picked up on Pa's new obsession too, and they couldn't make sense of it either. So I organised an investigation to help me get to the bottom of this case. I didn't feel like I could ask him directly yet, so I enlisted three generations from my family to work out why Pa was so enamoured with these books. I live nearest to my mum, so I talked to her first. She's very close to my Pa.
Lynn Ellen Gillespie.
And what's your relationship with John?
He's my stepdad, but he really is my dad. He's been my dad for like the last...
Oh, God. Let me explain why we're laughing. We're an emotional family and we cry at the drop of a hat. Mum started tearing up after only my second question.
Well, I think John's a country person through and through. He was born in Moyoo, which is outside Albury, really underneath the snowfields. And he was raised on a sheep farm and... You get that feeling when you meet him. He always wears his R.N. Williams clothes and his special R.N. Williams boots and his moleskins, and that's never going to change. And that's who John is.
I wanted to make sure I wasn't imagining things. So I checked with Mum to see if Pa really did mention The Cuckoo's Calling as often as I thought.
Well, he talked about it a lot. I don't remember exactly when, but he mentioned it lots and lots of times. He was very into it, and he thought that the author was amazing and probably the best female author he'd ever read, second to only one other.
So we knew he liked it, but we still didn't know why. I needed to get closer to the source, with the one person that knows him best, my Nan.
I can't remember exactly, but I do remember him saying... This lady's a great writer. Yeah. I love this book.
Nan and Pa now live in a retirement village in Sydney. It has a small library in the compound, and it was there that Pa originally found the series. Because the library is only replenished every so often, and there's a high demand for books among the residents, he was getting each instalment of the series months after the rest of the world.
Did it seem like he liked this more than other things that he reads?
Yes, I think he did. Yeah, he was very taken with it.
Did he say anything in particular about them?
Just that he loved the writing, the way it was written. It didn't say much else. Not to me, yeah.
So not even Nan was getting the inside scoop. But I knew this was no ordinary book to Pa. I hadn't seen him this passionate about a book in a while. I can't explain why this preoccupied me so much, why I had become almost obsessed with getting to the bottom of this. It was a bit ridiculous. But the question remained... Why did he love this series so much? There was only one sensible option left. We needed to read the source material. My mum volunteered herself as tribute, and we crossed our fingers that we would get the answers we sought. So Mum got stuck into reading, and initially all she remarked was that it was funny. Pa does love a laugh, but I wasn't convinced. I knew there had to be something else. A reason why he would take a leap into the great abyss of pop culture, so far from the comfort of his usual reading habits. But then a few days later, Mum pulled me aside. She told me she'd figured it out. Cormor and Strike limped to the bar.
He was so tired that the removal of his prosthesis took twice the time it usually did.
Now he was a limping man. Strike undid the straps of his prosthetic, easing it from the aching stump, removing the gel liner. Although Harry Potter is famous for his lightning scar, the main character of The Cuckoo's Calling, Cormor and Strike, was not as famous for his missing leg. It takes until page 48 of The Cuckoo's Calling for the reader to find out that Cormoran Strike is an amputee, just like my pa.
So after you read the books, did your perception of why Pa was reading them and loving them change?
No, I just got it because I think Pa, he could relate to it because obviously he's an amputee, and so he can relate to all the really specific things that happened to Cormoran about the limb and about the pain and the everyday up and down stairs and how hard all those things are. And no, it just made more sense.
It makes more sense.
Hello.
How you going?
Good.
That's good.
I'm knifing him.
You're
a knife? He's well, sitting there, and often I look out the window.
Yeah.
There was a little dab of paint on the outside.
He's been
wanting
to clean it up.
You mean
it's been
knife,
bothering
you. And I thought, yeah, well, I'll bloody go and do that while I'm doing nothing else. Yeah.
Hey, do you want a cup of tea first?
Yeah, sure. You guys want one?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Always have a cup of tea.
Yeah, I'm John Mann. I'm your, well...
granddaughter.
Essentially, your grandfather.
What do you mean by essentially?
Essentially, well, I'm not your grandfather at all, because I'm a second marriage to Elaine.
Yeah.
And your grandfather is dead, and that Elaine's ex-husband.
Mm, so not by blood. But definitely the only grandfather I've known.
Yes, I feel like I'm your grandfather.
I let Pa know that Mum and I had done some research. We had become intrigued by his obsession with these books. It felt a bit weird confronting him about all this. But I wanted to ask about the main character, Cormoran Strike.
I think he's a likeable character. To me, he's a likeable character because I think right from the start, he knew he was going to solve those mysteries. He had that confidence about him. And I like that because I think that sort of, I relate to that a bit because, you know, anything I've taken on, I knew I could do. And in my own mind, I never told anybody else. You know, you don't take things. I would never take something on that I couldn't do. So I respected all those qualities. Of the character. I mean, I know it's fictitious.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I still felt like there was something missing. Pa had mentioned the books so many times. He raved about them. So why had he never mentioned that he shared what was, in my eyes, such a major trait with the main character?
I try to keep the fact that I'm an amputee as far as possible. Nobody needs to know if they don't have to know. You know, if I'm getting around anywhere I'm getting about, people don't have to know I'm an amputee. If it happens to find out, well, I don't care about it, but you don't broadcast those sorts of things, I don't think. That's the way I was brought up, I think, you know.
You don't want pity.
You know, most certainly don't. And that's the other reason is that when I get... You know, you are aware that I get these jumping pains in there. Well, that's when we don't go out because I don't want to draw attention to myself, and that's what it'll do if you do that. But, the thing causing pain and aggravation sort of, yeah, you just keep that to yourself. And he used to keep it to himself as well. I admired that as well,
And so that's how I stumbled upon another trait Pa and Cormoran had in common, their humility. He noticed Wardle's curious gaze roaming over his lower legs as he returned to the table. Under different circumstances, he might have banged the prosthesis hard against the table leg and said, "It's this one." I like to imagine that if Pa was ever in this position, he would respond in exactly the same way.
That story was by Chloe Gillespie with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon and sound design by Alex Dennison. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian state coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our community coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beck Fiery is our SYN production manager. Michael Bryden is my co-host. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com, and while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.